listening to the 480 Corecast with Cliff and Eric.
Hello, welcome to the Corecast. I'm Clifton.
And I'm Eric. And today we are talking to Hugh Jackman. No, I'm just kidding.
We're talking to Derek Hackman.
Derek Hackman of The Breaking Pattern, formerly of Ezzer.
Yes, formerly of apparently a couple other no-name bands that fought over each other because certain members were sleeping with other members' girlfriends.
Which we won't get into.
We won't get into until we listen to the actual podcast, which will happen in 2 minutes and 67 seconds.
Which he didn't get into.
No, he didn't get into. Derek was a cool guy. We've only known him basically from, or at least I've only known him basically from going to shows. And I was telling him about like the first time that Ezra played. We played with them at Club Red, which was a show. We didn't even know anyone on that show. And then as we were like setting up, they were right after us or right before? I think we were before them. So, like, as we're getting ready to go up on stage, like, they're getting ready to perform, and we're just sitting in the back of the venue talking about, like, gear and bands and band ideals and stuff. And it was really cool. We had a really good conversation with them. And then, as we get up on stage, we play, and then we get off, and they're like, oh, that's so amazing, hey! And then they get up on stage, they play, and we're like, oh my gosh, that was so amazing! So, like, both of us just totally fed off each other. And then, from then, we never played another show, and it's kind of sad. I hope that I get to be on stage with them sometime soon. But yeah, I mean, that's where we met him the first time, and then from then we just kept seeing him at local shows, and I've been able to talk to him a little bit more after that, and it's just now we finally got him in here in the studio, and we got to learn a lot about his life, which was kind of cool.
Yeah, I never met him before. I've always heard of his band. I've heard them before, and they actually played with Murrieta once at a show. It was from Indian Lakes. They played with them, and yeah, so I'd heard the name, you know, Ezra before, and I'd seen him, and I listened to him and whatnot, and I never really realized that's who it was until today.
We put two and two a lot together. Yeah. Derek was a cool story because he talked a lot about how music wasn't his first idea of what he wanted. I don't know. It was more like his parents didn't want him to go into music, but he pushed himself to learn the guitar almost obsessively and then continued on in that aspect and continued on to move on to like join worship bands and then he'd start his own bands with those people. And now he is where he is today. And The Breaking Pattern is going to be doing really good in the future. They just started up on their new moniker, but they've already played 2 sold out shows.
Which is amazing.
Amazing. I wish I could say that I've played a sold out show. I think I've played a half sold out show, maybe. And I mean, and so they're on their way to really good things. And Derek is also friends with lots of good and up and coming bands here in the Valley. He's roommates with one of the guys from Never Let This Go, which is just now about to embark on their U.S. tour, which is really cool. So, I mean, he's got a lot of good contacts now, but he honestly started from nothing, and we get to hear his story about how he started from absolutely nothing and made himself to who he is today in the local scene.
Right. We also get to hear about his passion for music and his passion for Arizona, which is awesome because he's not originally from Arizona.
Yeah.
So that's pretty cool. And anybody from Arizona knows how much, you know, the state means to them. And that was kind of cool to see that passion and to kind of hear about it. So without further ado, let's go ahead and get into the episode.
Here we go.
Here we go.
Hey, I'm making noise now. Are you making noise?
I think I am.
Are you making noise?
I'm making tons of noise.
Hey, we're all making noise. This is perfect.
Cool.
All right. Hey, Derek, thanks for coming out today and gracing us with your presence. I'm sure you're a very busy man.
Not a problem. I appreciate you inviting me on.
We are here in the Corecast studio talking to Derek Hackman. And Derek, we wanted to talk a lot about you as a musician. It's kind of cool because I don't know you very well, so this is going to be a good learning experience for me, man. And for Eric too.
I don't know you at all.
No, we just met. It was cool.
Where do you live around here?
I live down in Tempe, actually right by Mill and ASU. So
okay, right down in Tempe.
Yeah.
And I know that just recently you have started, you've changed your current band, or well, I guess it was your current band, Ezra, to now The Breaking Pattern.
Yeah.
And that kind of moved around. So talk about a little bit about like how that change happened or where it came from.
Right, so I was doing Ezra for a couple years. It's kind of my first entry into the music scene, for the most part. It was my first serious attempt, at least. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we put out two EPs. And sorry if I'm blanking on this. No, So I lost all my original members, and it wasn't like a one, like everyone just got up and left. It was kind of like a slow process. Like my original bassist left to go get married in California, and like my drummer went to the military. My guitarist like bought a house somewhere out in the middle of nowhere and like got a full-time job or whatever and just couldn't do it anymore. But at the same time, I like wanted to reinvent myself already, and I felt like the new music that I was writing was not anything completely different, but I felt like I had finally found my sound and my tone and like what the direction I wanted to go in. So I went to a new group of musicians, people I knew throughout the local scene, other people that I knew were also serious like I was about doing music professionally. And so I kind of thought it was time for kind of a new attempt. But at the same time, we had gained enough esteem in the local scene as Ezra that I didn't want to completely let go of Ezra, and I didn't want to completely let go of some of those songs that I knew meant a lot to fans. So instead of just like scrapping it all and like doing a whole new thing, I just figured, why not just change the name and kind of give it a whole like rebranding of sorts.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So that's what the idea was. So after some brainstorming and after kind of, and it was something that was on my heart for a while. I had the band name up my sleeve for a while. I had these songs, they've been written for a while. So it wasn't like a instantaneous thought. It was something that I'd really thought about for a long time, and it was actually a really hard decision. But once the decision was made, I was really excited for doing something new.
Okay. Well, Mime Light played a show with Ezra not too long ago. It was about a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
And me and Dion, the other guitarist in the band, we're big gearheads.
Yeah, I've noticed.
We sit around and talk about gear all the time. We're texting each other about new amps and stuff like that.
Clifton was just talking to me about the new Gibson guitars on the way over here and how he hates them.
Yes. Have you seen the new Gibson guitars?
I have not. What's their deal?
Okay, so don't quote me on everything, but Gibson has been around for a long time, and yeah. The biggest I always liked them because they had this really traditional feel.
Yeah.
They had mm-hmm. the old, you know, like not so much lacquer and everything. Like it felt like a nice guitar, and it looked like a nice guitar.
Yeah.
And then they've put out these new ones that are like the flashy paint jobs and like I hate that tiger stripe sort of look. I hate that paint job. And they just kept putting those out. And then in 2015, they came out and said, we're only doing this from now on. Like we're making like these futuristic guitars with like the tuning pegs at the top that do it for you.
Oh, yeah.
You've seen that?
Okay, I have seen that, yeah.
And they've changed their whole model.
Yeah, I thought that was a little strange too because they are kind of a classic. Like when you think of it, you think of like... You think of a Les Paul. No, I play an SG, and it's a tank, man. I love my guitar. I've like thrown it through, literally have thrown it through amps, and dropped it multiple times on stage. Broke my strap locks. I've gone through like 6 pairs of strap locks in my life, and it still holds up. It still goes.
But, I know.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, I'm not like one to stop the future of music or anything like that. I mean, I'm curious where they go with it, but they're definitely a classic guitar. So I hope they don't completely, I don't know. My whole album was pretty much written though, like Fender through a Vox, that whole classic chimey kind of sound.
So, yeah.
I mean, whatever. I'm getting a Fender anyways.
I just didn't like it because I think how they put it was like, we're not making these guitars anymore because they're budget model guitars or whatever. Like we've cut corners on purpose to make these guitars cheaper for you as a consumer. We're not doing that anymore. We're making guitars now that are really nice and you consumers just have to deal with it and pay the extra $400. Anyway, that's just me on my soapbox. I apologize. I, Gibson. Right,
back to your...
Hey, Gibson, if you're listening to this podcast...
They will never sponsor
let
this
me,
podcast.
Let me be on your design team. I can make it. I can make a guitar. I can do it.
They're going to shut us down now. Thanks, Clifton.
That'll be the only email.
Sorry I brought that up. Anyway, back to you and Dion being gearheads.
Anyway, the reason I said that was that... I hate to say this. It sounds really rude. A lot of times when bands are setting up on stage, Dion and I are looking at each other as they set up, and we're kind of judging the band before they even get on based on what gear they have on stage. And so when we saw Ezra for the first time as they're loading up, we see your other guitarist, and he has like an orange...
Well, he's a gearhead.
Is he?
Our original guitarist, he's a professional sound tech. That's what he does. He sound techs for like churches and stuff around the valley.
We saw him pull up. He has nice orange combo, and he has his like switcher guitar. And then you had your nice pedal board with all your effects on it. And we're like, okay, this is gonna be a good band.
This is gonna be good. Yeah, we're definitely we still use like even my new guitarist Sam. When I lost Adam was like that was a final straw, and he was the one who me and him did most of the brain work behind Ezer, and that's when I really switched the name over was when I lost Adam. He's like a sound tech, a total gearhead. So he was the one telling me, okay, you need to buy this kind of guitar. You need to buy this kind of amp. You should use these kind of pedals. And he would literally sit there and blend our amp tones during practice just so we would have like a perfect live sound. And then when we'd go to a show, the first thing he would do is talk to the sound tech. And then we would judge the other band's sound and like gauge a room. And then we would readjust our amps according to the room and the sound of the other bands and to how the sound tech was teching that night.
He's that good?
He was intense.
Dang.
So, wow. Yeah, Sam's not that intense. Like, he's not, like, telling sound techs how to do their job or anything like that. But he's definitely... I think he plays through, like, an Axe FX and, like, you know, just, like, the crazy stuff you use in studios, not stuff you generally see a whole lot live.
We always try and get a good relationship with the sound tech because I think a lot of people don't realize that they're the keeper of your sound.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That they are everything. If you want to have a good show, you kiss their ass. Like, I'm like on a first name basis with a lot of sound techs for a good reason, you know.
Right.
And I believe like if you really want to go over the top, maybe even like tip them a little bit, or like if you want to ask for a little something extra, like some reverb here and there. Yeah. And a lot of times I give them my set list. And we'll like have areas plotted out where I want them to add reverb and things like that. So I usually am like very, not like super thorough because I don't want to like step on their toes, but like I definitely kiss their butt and you know.
Yeah. You don't want to be a diva on stage because then they're going to make you sound like crap.
Yeah. There's definitely horror stories. I've seen some crazy. Crazy horror stories between sound techs getting pissed off at bands. So I will never cross that.
I've seen
threshold.
A lot of touring bands that basically walk off. I've seen a touring band walk off stage because the sound tech wasn't doing what they wanted to do, and they just were like, "All right, we're done." And just walk off stage.
Yeah, but I'm never. Yeah, shoot, yeah. I'll just go straight live. I don't care. Like, I would
do that too. All you have to really give me is just a PA that I can hear my voice out of. That's it. Oh, not even me, I guess. I could play a show where I can't even hear myself sing. I could just put in earplugs. That's all I need to play a show, really. And even then, I guess if I don't have that, I'll just do it anyway. I don't need mic'd up drums and a mic'd up guitar amp and all this stuff. But that's just the standard. That's just what it is.
Mm-hmm. Honestly, as a local band, we played some super rough stages, and the scene's getting a lot better, and there's like definitely some really good venues coming up and better sound techs, and people are kind of learning it a little bit better. But when we were first coming out in some of these venues, I remember one show, we didn't have drum monitors. And so like, our drummer was like, I don't have a monitor. I can't hear what my vocalist or anyone's doing. So like, and we just had to suck it up. Like the guys were just like, sorry, you're gonna have to play. Like,
yeah.
And so we basically just had to play off instinct. Mm-hmm. And it was like, all right, dude, like you play, we'll play to you, and like, good luck. You know?
And see, growing up, we were like, Clifton has been in high school, like it was in a band in high school throughout, you know, till now, basically, and that's how they played. They didn't play backyard shows with no monitors at all, with just a crappy PA.
Like, what's a monitor?
Yeah,
yeah, right.
So you already got used to that.
Yeah, remember the basketballs the basketball field. What's it called? Court.
Court.
The basketball.
The basketball field.
The basketball swim field. Swim.
Place. Remember that baseball court?
Yeah, the baseball. The basketball court that the guy had in his backyard, mm-hmm. and we played on that. Mm-hmm. That was a perfect example.
Yeah,
that was like 2 12-inch speakers that were like way in front of the band because they had to be or else the mics would be squeaking and feeding back.
Right.
Back. That's just how we did it.
Oh man,
sometimes those are the best shows though.
I know they were some of the most memorable. Yeah. I had the most fun probably because a lot of your friends were hanging out there.
Right.
You know.
Oh man, yeah, I played like the early days. Was just like playing in parks, playing in like freaking bar mitzvah, like like whatever you could get,
yeah.
Like especially like 4 or 5 years ago, because when there wasn't music venues like in Phoenix, like everything was getting shut down.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the list goes on forever.
Yeah,
I don't even know if we want to go down that route. But you know, One Place, Modified Arts, Clubhouse, just like Brick
right.
House, just
the
all
fix.
These venues, the
yeah.
Fix, all these awesome venues in. But on top of like playing for promoters and things like that, like promoters have gotten a lot better too. Back then, the promoters were like, I remember playing for a promoter selling like 100 tickets and they didn't give us a single dollar after the show. And they like booked 8 bands on the bill. And I was just like, are you kidding me? I got 100 people. I made you $1,000 and you're not going to give me a single dollar.
That's ridiculous.
You're going to put 8 bands on this bill. Like, it was just such a greedy
yeah.
system. And it was killing whatever, strangling the life out of whatever music scene there is.
Well, booking The Fix back in the day, I heard cost, what, like $3,000, $4,000?
I don't know.
I'm being sarcastic.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Right? This is like...
I got you now.
It's like house, you know?
Well, let's talk about... Let's kind of go back to the beginning a little bit.
Yeah.
What at what age did you kind of... get familiar with music and say, you know, I like music. Like, like what kind of bands did you listen to at that age?
So, I mean, it's hard to really pinpoint a specific time where it's like, oh, music is like everything to me.
Mm-hmm.
But I do remember, like, if I want to go way back to straight up childhood, it goes back. I was like, I remember being I was a baby and I had like ear infections and I had like tubes in my ear and I couldn't hear for the first like year, like a couple months of my life or something like that. My parents talk about this story where after I got the tubes taken out and I could hear again, that as a child in my baby crib, I would take the cup and like just make all sorts of, like, I'd be like goo goo gaga, like super loud and like hitting my baby crib. And growing up, I didn't grow up in like a musical, I didn't even grow up in like an artistic family. My family was all just like math and science and, but my sister was a very talented singer and violinist, and I was always super into my dad's music, and I always had these fantasies as a kid, like, you know, when you think you're a superhero or whatever. Mine was always like, I wanted to be like a composer and a rock star, and I wanted to play all these different genres. I wanted to just like be a crazy awesome famous musician.
Mm-hmm.
Not even for the fame, like as a kid you don't even think about fame, you just think about like superpowers. My superpower was always being an awesome musician. And so I think it was like always kind of like there in my blood, but my parents never recognized it. They never, like, I'd always bang on the piano. My mom would tell me to stop and get off the piano. But eventually I moved around a lot as a kid. So during one of my moves, like I moved a lot frequently. And so one of my moves, I think I was in middle school going from Georgia to Tennessee where my sister had gotten a guitar for Christmas that year, and because again she was like a violinist at a young age and she was a good musician, but I started playing that guitar during the move. Like, I was like trapped in an apartment with my family for an entire summer with no friends. I wasn't at school yet. I had nothing to do, so I just
mm-hmm.
like I learned about guitar tabs and was on, you know, those websites back in the day of guitar tabs on them and learning songs, and I basically taught myself music. I had a teacher for the first year on and off. He was
mm-hmm.
like in a band that toured a lot. So I only had like probably only like 10 or so real guitar lessons in my life. And then I tried taking guitar lessons again. And I, at that point, after like a year or two, had already learned a bunch of Jimi Hendrix songs and could play Voodoo Child. And after like a summer of just being by myself, locked in a room playing guitar, you just get really good really quick.
Right.
It's all you do for 8 hours, 10 hours, just all day.
That's
right.
The secret. That's what I have to do.
Yeah, I just locked myself in a bedroom for literally, I'll be horribly depressed and have no life and do that from the moment you wake up to the moment you go back to sleep. And so I remember I had a teacher trying to teach me like Yankee Doodle, and I was like, dude, I can shred Hendrix.
I don't need you anymore.
Yeah, so
let me teach you something.
So I quit. I never did lessons. I kind of taught myself.
Yeah.
So by the time I was like, so I moved again and had the same situation where I was just in my room all day an entire summer doing probably close to like 12, 14, like literally from the moment I woke up to the moment I slept, I was just playing guitar till like fingers bled and I just couldn't handle it. Hmm. So I was in high school and I moved around a couple times, and I think it was like freshman year to sophomore year. And I was, by that point in my life, I was conscious enough to want to be the cool kid in school. And I remember playing a talent show, and I was told, some other kid in school told me, yo, dude, like, why are you going to play guitar at the talent show? You're stupid. Didn't you know? I'm not going to say the kid's name, but there's another kid who was like playing a talent show. And this kid was like your stereotypical, had like hair down to like his knees, like wore Metallica t-shirts every day. Just like your stereotypical, like shreddy guitar player. And he was like known as the guitar player in the uh-huh. school. And I was like this new kid wearing like Abercrombie and stuff from like the South where preppy and the West is not. And so they're like, dude, you're going to get killed. And I was like, what? Because this cow wears Metallica shirts? I can't play guitar? So I went and played that talent show, and I played the guitar with my teeth behind my head. I was like doing tap solos. I was just wanking. It was probably honestly terrible, and I hope to never see a video of me playing.
Well, what you didn't know is that we actually found that video.
I hope not. It was like the most bullshit video, but like, you know, I went to the talent show, and all of a sudden I became like the cool kid in school. And
nice.
That was when I was like, oh, this music thing is like making me friends and it's cool. I think what got me, you're going to hear me talk about the local scene a lot because I have a very big heart for the local scene, but mm-hmm. I started going to local shows about the age 15, and that's really where I started finding like my identity and kind of getting away from, you know, I fell into kind of like a rough crowd, and it wasn't until like, it was either I was like partying and doing really dumb things, or I was going out to local shows. And so I was going to like legitimately two or three local shows a week, from like the age of like sophomore year of high school throughout the rest of my high school life. And so even now I have like a huge heart for Arizona. And even though I want to be a professional musician, cause you know, I kind of grew up always just dreaming of that, and playing and learning and writing, there's also a part of me that really just wants to be not just like a recognized Arizona artist, but someone who contributes back to the scene mm-hmm. and sees it like nurtured back to health after all the crap that it used to, that I had gone through. And I just want to kind of give back to what I felt like gave me the life I have now. So
going back to when you were younger, when playing guitar 12 to 14 hours a day or whatever. I mean, I don't hear that a lot. I really don't. Was it an obsession that became with you, that you had to become the best guitarist ever, or was it something like personality wise, like I can't make friends and this is just what I'm going to do instead of playing video games or reading books or whatever.
Actually, I mean, it's kind of a combination, but I'm actually really glad you asked that. When I was, so I have an obsessive personality. Like, so I get on binges of things really easily. I try not to watch Netflix for this exact reason, because I will legitimately, I watched the new season of Game of Thrones in one day. If that explains the kind of person, I have like no restraint. So when I was still kind of younger, I think around like middle school or whatever, I was playing a video game, Warcraft,
okay,
to be exact. And I would sit there all day in class, and this is before I play guitar. So I'd sit there in class all day thinking of strategies, talking to friends about strategies, researching strategies, playing nonstop, to the point that I was starting to skip school and skip class and play sick just so I could stay home and play video games. I would not stop playing video games. So I go out the day, and it didn't matter if I had like a good day on video games or a bad day. I would just feel so unproductive that I would like be going to bed at night and I'd feel like terrible about myself, that like I spent all this time and all this energy and all this thought. And I realized, like, I was spending just months of just nothing but thinking of the same thing over and over again. So I was like, I have to do something that's, like, going to build and be constructive. And I had that thought, but I never really knew where to pour that energy until, like, I remember having a friend who was like, oh, I play guitar. And I thought he was the coolest kid in the world for playing guitar. And my sister got a guitar. And I was like, well, what if I could be, like, my friend who plays guitar, who's really cool? And so when I found guitar, I was like, this is what I should be doing. Screw video games. And yeah, I think there was a big social aspect to it too. I was like, I'm going to be the new kid in school. I want to have something. I don't want to be known for a guy who just plays video games all day.
We talked to Randy Day, who he was homeschooled, mm-hmm. and he talked about how he was tried to use guitar at first as a way to fit in as well. Where he's just like, I don't. Everyone's going to look at me as the weird homeschooled kid, and I don't mm-hmm. want to be that. So I'm going to try and join these bands so that I can fit in somewhere, because he wasn't fitting in a lot of spots. So that's interesting that you say that too.
Yeah, I think because I moved around, and I'm not naturally an outgoing, like I don't think I'm naturally an extrovert by any means. I think my tendencies are very introverted, and I definitely prefer, like, honestly, I would stay and watch Netflix every single day if it wasn't for myself telling me, Derek, you can't do that. yeah, it's just, you're not, that's not okay for your health. So I think
now you're telling me.
Yeah, it's not good. Like, it's fun. It's a great life. Don't do it. So I think guitar, and especially because I moved around a lot, and I got to reinvent myself a lot, moving around a lot. And I was definitely bullied. I think everyone was bullied in middle school. I think middle school just mm-hmm. sucks for everyone. But yeah, I was definitely bullied really, really hard. And I moved, and I wanted to be cool, and I learned guitar, and it sort of made me cool. And then I moved again to here in Arizona, and I learned guitar, and it made me really freaking cool when I won the talent show. And I was like, all right, I should keep doing this. I definitely don't play 14 hours a day now. Like, you know, I've got work and responsibilities and things, and I just,
those.
And I focus my energy more, because in being in a band, there's so much, like, managerial aspect to mm-hmm. it that actually – the majority of my thought now that the album's pretty much wrapped up, I can, my sole purpose in life now is not learning guitar. It's getting this album into the hands and ears and minds of everyone I can.
Right.
So, like, that's kind of my obsession now, I guess, if you want to look at it like mm-hmm. that.
That's interesting.
So what age did you come to Arizona?
I was 15, okay. I think. 15, yeah. I was a sophomore in high school.
And what brought you here? Was it just your family moving all the time? And
yeah, it was weird. My dad's I think I get it from my dad. He's the one, I hope he doesn't hear this, but he doesn't support my music whatsoever. Even now, I don't talk to him about my band. Like, it was just like not a good topic in my family. He has this preconceived notion, because he grew up in the 70s, you know, just like all rock stars are druggies and, you know. But anyways, he was a doctor. And my mom was a nurse, so I grew up in a medical family, and I always thought I was going to go to med school, too. So my dad was a doctor, but the problem about being a doctor is it's an ambitious career because it takes a long time to get there. But once you're there, it has a ceiling, and there's nowhere else to go. So if you're mm-hmm. a naturally ambitious person, like, that's soul-sucking because you want to progress.
Right.
So I think my dad is a lot like me in the regards that he, as a doctor, couldn't ever settle down. And so he would, like, be a doctor, and then he, like, left to go be, like, a chief of medicine at, like, some hospital, and then, like, to be a medical director, and now he works for, like, insurance companies as, like, a medical director. And so he never was, he was a doctor, but only ran his own practice for, like, 5-6 years before he was like, all right, I'm done with my own practice because I, like, maxed out where I could go with this. So mm-hmm. what's the next thing I can do?
Oh, that stinks.
Yeah, so that's why we moved, because he always got bored, basically, which is, you know, didn't lead to a good relationship between me and my father moving that much. But I mean, he's a good man, and I love him to death, and I love my family, and I do thank him for where I'm at now in life. But in terms of the music stuff, that's, you know, I think I got my dad's brain, but I think our vision for the future is a little bit different,
right?
So when I was younger too, my dad was a big musician, and music was always big in my household. However, my dad never, ever pushed us to mm-hmm. do any one set thing. It's I don't know. It's a good thing and it's a bad thing, I guess, because, like, I never had a lot of direction at a younger age of, like, you know, hey, you know, if you're like this, maybe you should continue on this path or something. It was just more just like, whatever, you can do whatever you want. But, and so, like, I think I found music the same way that he found music, where it was more of, like, a calming aspect, or more of just something that was nice to do. And then was kind of but that was the thing too, is that, like, what year did you graduate high school?
08.
08. Okay. Well, okay. I was gonna say, cause around the time that we were in high school, that was almost like the cool thing to do was to be in a band.
Yeah.
Was that the same thing for you too?
I came, so my high school was like brand new. I was a first 4-year graduating class. So, we didn't have any real set traditions, but because we didn't, we had terrible sports because of that. So the cool thing was to go to shows.
Okay.
And we live, I was at Anthem, Arizona. So I went way, I live way up north. And so we would drive like 30 minutes just to go to shows. But yeah, all our friends were, like Sandra Day O'Connor, kids in these other schools. And they were like, I'm friends with people who started like Knights of the Abyss, Job for a Cowboy, like huge names back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
I guess they're still big names. I'm not really sure. But huge names for Arizona back then. So yeah, it was like, oh my gosh, you're in a band, and all we go is do local shows all the time. So it was like this really cool thing, but it was really hard because no one had actually done it in our school because we were so new and stuff. But that's how I started singing, actually. I wasn't a singer. I was just a guitarist, and I tried making bands, but there was no dude in our school who would sing other than like maybe like a theater kid or something. And it was just like no one wanted to be in bands, and if they did want to be in bands, they were like terrible human beings who were just like mean. And so finally I was just like, you know what, I'm just gonna sit in my car all day and just like sing like brand new in early November. I was a little emo kid.
We all were, don't worry.
Oh, yeah. I love that stuff.
Yeah. So I grew up on like that whole, you know, 2000 mid-2000s emo stuff, and so I just sit in my car all day and sing. And the first time that I really sung in public, like I think I sung like once or twice in like church. And then it was my senior graduation, which had like 5,000 people or something like that. And it was like my first time singing in public.
Wow.
And I sang like our like valedictory song or whatever. And I almost crapped my pants, dude. It was terrifying.
That'd be funny. You're like, you were the first one ever. So you're just like, this is our new school song. don't look at me.
Yeah, it was, oh man. Yeah, so that was it. That was like cool, when though. I first started singing. Yeah, so it was kind of a cool thing.
Yeah,
but no one had really done it at the same time. So there was a lot of like, I didn't have a whole lot of people to follow in their footsteps. I definitely didn't have any connections coming into the music scene. I've been doing it for an embarrassing long, long time. To be at like whatever stage we're at now, you know.
Do you remember any like memorable shows that you went to in high school or anything that was really fun?
Oh yeah, I mean there's a ton. Like I said, I went to so many. But the first local show that I went to was A Change of Pace at CCV, which was it like they destroyed. It blew my mind. So my first show ever was a Modest Mouse concert. And I was just like, I had my mind blown, was like, this is the coolest thing I've ever done. So the first show I ever saw was Modest Mouse. I'm still a huge diehard Modest Mouse fan because of it.
We just saw them.
Really?
We did?
What am I thinking of? I'm thinking of Cursive. Never mind.
Oh, okay. Yeah, we saw Cursive.
Never mind.
There was this really cool Cover the Crescent show like a week or two ago. And they did. There was a local band that covered Modest Mouse. And then my friend's local band, Ryan Ostrom from Alan Penny, he did Brand New.
Oh yeah.
And it was I remember like the that
because that showed up on Bands in Town as Brand New coming to Crescent Ballroom. So all these people are posting on Facebook, Brand New's coming to Crescent Ballroom, and they go to buy tickets, and they're all like, oh, never mind, it's just some band covering Brand New.
They did awesome though. They killed it.
I wanted to go to that. I don't know why I couldn't. I had something going on that night, but
it was fantastic. And there's a Jimmy World cover
band.
I was hoping to see Jim Adkins there. I don't know if he showed up or not, but
hey, he hangs out at Crescent all the time.
Yeah,
he lives down the street.
Yeah, so. He's definitely around.
Yeah.
I want him, you know, he needs to come out. I'll cover his set next time. But anyway,
sorry to get off that topic.
It's cool, man. Yeah, I mean, there's always good local shows. But yeah, the first one I saw here was A Change of Pace at CCV, and that was where I was like, I have to play, like, live. I have to play locally. And then I got really into I was really into Lydia, and I saw Lydia, like, I'm the biggest fan of their first CD, which is nowhere to be found. They like basically destroyed it. It's not on iTunes. It's not on Spotify. They don't sell it at shows. So I give it to every young kid who's a Lydia fan. I'm like, you don't know Lydia. Let me show you. So I always send them the first CD.
We know that CD all too well.
Oh yeah.
December. Yeah, man.
We grew up on that CD.
We grew up on that CD. Yeah. Those guys. Those guys, we were playing shows with them when they were still playing those songs to begin with.
Wow,
and, like,
really?
The mm-hmm. first time, like I
Colton played a show in a backyard with them.
Yeah. Do you know? I don't remember all the songs. The song where it's like, "This place is going dead."
Yeah.
The black bracelet and all that. That's a terrible rendition of that song.
Sorry, like
I'm not a Lydia cover band. I'm really bad at that. But yeah, like those songs we were listening to for a long time. That was like that was like their first set that they put together. They just recorded it on a CD, and that was super cool to see. But you're right, like I don't see that anywhere. The people that everyone knows the CD after that. That's what they think.
Illuminate. And I was at the Illuminate release at Modified, which they did 2 days in a row. So that was a cool local show too. But I saw Lydia in like a parking lot once at a mall. I saw the Main play their first show, which was at a Starbucks. Which the reason I saw that was because Lydia promoted them on MySpace, and I was like, "Oh, if Lydia says they're good," and I went and saw them. And then of course the Main blows up like less than a year. Yeah. It was ridiculous. They were like super talented and super well connected. So just like the stars aligned for them.
Yeah, they went really fast.
They went super, and they're still just like. You know, they pay a lot of tribute to the local scene too. So I can't like hate on them for being blowing up and being jealous, because it's like, dude, they love Arizona. Mm-hmm. And
yeah,
I love anyone that loves Arizona. So,
so when you got done with high school, you did move on to college. So what was your mindset there? Were you kind of like, all right, I'm growing up now, I'm going to be a musician, or was that not the first thing on your mind?
See, again, I was always told that, you know, music's not like a viable career path, and it's not something you can do, and you need to focus on school. And so, you know, I listened to the advice of my parents and kind of common wisdom. So I went off to college, and I had a real, again, I was pre-med. I was going to be a doctor too. And I went off to study molecular and cellular biology and did graduate in the top of my class, but I went insane, almost literally insane. And that's why, so I would, I don't even know how to, so I would study ridiculously hard things. And on top of that, I was volunteering at the ER. I was running like two different worship ministries. I was, and that's when I started the band too, because I needed to write in order to let all that energy out. Cause I'd sit there and I'd study for hours and hours and hours, lock myself in my room, studying. And I was taking like unprescribed, like Ritalin. I was like drinking heavily. I was drinking cough syrup every night to go to sleep. I started smoking like cigarettes, and I was just like all kind of chemicals, like nicotine, caffeine, Adderall, Tylenol, just everything was in my system when I was going through college. And the only way I could get any sort of relief was by writing, was just to like wail on my guitar and sing and scream, and that was kind of where Ezer really started. So before Ezer started, me and Adam had been playing in like church, and we actually toured as like he was doing like a worship like missionary team, basically. Okay. So we would go and we played up and down California and like a couple other states and all around Arizona, and like Flagstaff, we'd play kids camps, things like that. And we would, and that was kind of before Ezer, and we like wrote a couple songs together, but nothing like super serious. And it was really just to like play for churches, and it was kind of like a side gig where we made some money off of it. And then when I went to college and I was starting to go insane, I had played like one or two local shows as like a solo acoustic artist at that point. Mm-hmm. So I had like this wealth of songs, and then I went to college, went insane, wrote all these songs, came back to Adam, was like, hey, can we take this band that we have, and we had the same members and everything, and can we turn it into something that's not a Christian band? Can we do something that's more mainstream, something that we can do like be a part of the local scene at, because I love being part of the local scene. And so originally that was just the idea, just play local shows. And so in college I had to write or I would have gone insane.
Where do you think that came from? Was it pressure to, you know, make your please your parents, or was it pressure to do the right thing, or what you thought was the right thing, or was it just that obsessive mentality of I'm about to graduate, I need to do everything I can to make the best thing way I can?
I think a lot of it was motivated by two things. I think I was motivated by pride, and I think I was motivated by fear. And I think the pride was proving to not just like my parents, not just to like my friend, because a lot of my high school buddies, they didn't even like go to college. They just like I said, I was in a rough crowd, and it didn't end well for most of them. So a lot of it was like, I had to get away from these guys and I have to go to college. Mm-hmm. And while I was there, I actually struggled because I didn't come from a good high school. I didn't come from a good education, and all these like private school and IB and all these like really intelligent kids are coming in and destroying. I wasn't doing good at first. And so I was like, no, I got to prove myself. And I intentionally picked, like, I don't think this is my exact, I do have a passion for science and I do love like biology, but I think a lot of it was like, I'm just going to pick a really hard major and just prove to myself that I can do it and I can do it better than anyone else. And like I said, I graduated cum laude with honors and academic distinction while doing tons of other things on top of it.
That's crazy, dude. I mean, props to that.
Thank you.
Yeah. It's really hard.
And I think, but I also had the fear of, well, I know music can't make money. I know music is like an impossible. It takes like luck and so many factors. But what no one explained to me and what I like to explain to kids coming up is you can have both lives. You can do two things. Like, you don't have to, it's not one or the other, and you don't have to sacrifice one for the other necessarily. I remember I went to this one local show, or I was playing a show. It was when Ezra had started, and I actually love this story. So we were playing, and this is back when the scene, like, tons of venues closed down. So we were playing this random, like, really fancy bar. Like, it was like a lounge of like bucket seats and stuff. So we were playing this lounge, and this like other band who was like somewhat more popular than us was playing on the bill. And I told the guy that I was in college, and he basically told me, like, you need to quit college and you need to become like a full-time band or you'll never make it. And his band literally breaks up. Not like, this story gets even better. So literally his band breaks up not even like months later, and he like is out of the world of music. And I don't even know where that kid went. I don't know. I'm sure he's working somewhere. He's not playing music. I know that for a fact. But not only did he say that, but then right as he said that, the promoter came up to me. He was like, is there anyone on your guest list? And I was like, yes, actually. And I don't know if you guys recognize this name. I'm just going to name drop real quick. But I was like, can you add David Marsh to the list, who was the manager of A Change of Pace, mm-hmm. who was coming out to scout our band that night? And the kid just like gave me this his jaw just dropped. And I was just like, oh, I need to quit school? So I was like, no, man, I'm doing it right. Unfortunately, A Change of Pace broke up, and I think he didn't, and he's not in the world of music anymore. But so nothing really came of it. But what I tell young kids is I think it's good to have a backup plan, because if I didn't have a backup plan, if I didn't have like an education or a job or anything to fall back on, I would still... And like I said, I think this is where fear really motivated me. I would be too scared to even like try and pursue music fully, because, you know, it's still the hardest industry there is, maybe outside of Hollywood. Mm-hmm. Like, there really is nothing harder than trying to be a musician, and there's nothing more ambitious than trying to be a musician. So have a sense of realism when you go at it. You can, and having a real job and having an education and all that makes me a better musician, because not only do I have like some finances to help me purchase better recordings, but I have more of a free schedule that I can write more. I have a set schedule where I come home every day and I can write, or I can go to practice. Mm-hmm. And like, it's just, I don't think you have to sacrifice one for the other necessarily. Of course, next year we're going on tour, and so I'm a little scared on what that all is going to mean for like work and things like that. But every job that I've held, I've been straight up that I'm a musician. I love music. And I've always just had the support of my bosses, and maybe I'm just really lucky in that regard, but it's definitely not impossible to have your foot in both worlds. And I think it's dumb to not have backup plans personally. I have friend bands who don't agree with that philosophy, but that's my personal view.
I think that's true. Cause we just talked to Steve, and, one thing I didn't know is that he told us that Mick Jagger, for example, is an economist. Basically, he studied economy at university, and that's what he did. And then, you know, then he got started in music. And so there's tons of different, you know, huge people that have these careers and were doctors and lawyers and then they become musicians. And that's something that's, I think, I never knew, which is kind
of
cool.
Yeah, I didn't know that a lot of the people that he talked about had too.
Yeah.
And I see the same thing too personally with me. I mean, I'm a little bit different. I almost said luckily. you're single and I'm married and I have kids.
Luckily.
What are you trying to say, Colton?
She doesn't listen to this. But if you do, I love you. So
I'm going to tell her.
No. So anyway, but yeah, I mean, you're single. I am married and I have kids. I can do both things at once. I want to put more time towards my passion of music, you know.
Yeah.
But I got to pay the bills. And even when you're starting up as a band too, I mean, it's really tough to, I don't know. It goes back kind of to the gear or something like that. Like you gotta kind of market yourself and make yourself look a certain way. And if you're only relying on the band itself to make enough money to make yourself look good, it's tough. You have to invest money into a business if you're making a business.
It's a business.
Yeah. You have to put your own money into it and make it happen. And so it's really tough to say, I'm gonna work a part-time job that pays me minimum wage for 20 hours a week and use the band to fund the band. It's tough.
Yeah.
You know, it's good to have a backup plan. It's good to always have a plan B. My wife and I talk about that a lot where she's like, this is your plan B. This is what we've decided, but I want you on your plan A. I want you to be working towards that. So,
that's,
you know,
awesome.
Let's give you that time to do that. But I also want to make sure that you can put food on the table. You know,
I think that's awesome because, I mean, I've had girlfriends in the past who are like, so you're going to be to med school, right? You're going to like, and they like try to take me away from like music and stuff. But, I'm dating a girl now and she's very supportive of it. And not only is she supportive of it, like she knew me, she didn't know I was in a band when we first started dating. Like I like to hide that fact because I don't want that whole, you know, whatever mentality. But I think she was actually attracted to the fact that I was ambitious and chasing my dreams. And mm-hmm. I think it's really good to have that kind of cheerleader and to have, cause it's such a hard, and you get screwed. Being in a band is just nothing but just getting screwed day in and day out all the time. And so to have someone to be able to vent to and have someone who can still support you, the emotional, there's so many emotional ups and downs of being in a band. It's good to have someone there emotionally. And I definitely, I know it would be really hard having kids and going on tour, having kids and having the money to split the finances. But, you know, I still want everything that I think every human wants, like family and things like that. But I still just envision a future where I can do what I love and travel the world. And, you know, I don't know. You can have both. I like to think you can. At least I'm going to try, you know.
No, you could definitely have both. I mean, you look at bands now. I mean, you look at Jimmy Eat World. They all have families and they're doing what they love. And obviously, I mean, they worked hard at the beginning and you know, kind of got big, you know, at the beginning and then kind of started their families afterwards, I think. But I mean, there's tons of bands that even start when they're 30 and then become big and they've had families and, you know, wives and mm-hmm. you can definitely do it.
I've seen that. Well, I see that happening now with a lot of the bands that we still listen to that have lasted the test of time that have been around now for like 10 or 15 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, when they were starting, I'm sure that they were all single. They were all living the touring life or the band life. And that's all that consumed them. But you hear about these stories of all these bands where it's like, I don't want this to be my life. Like I want to have a normal life, you know? And I think at a point in your career, you get to the point to where you're able to have a normal life and still run a band. I don't know if that's after you've been tried and true and you're super huge, you know, and just saying, oh, I'm going to play a show. We'll bring tons of people. But I mean, you'll get to that point in your life where you can have both as long as you keep with it. I think some people get frustrated because that they either haven't gotten what they wanted out of it or they haven't hit quick enough. And they just quit and give up and just choose one or the other.
Oh, yeah.
So, anyway, going back to Ezra, was Ezra your first band?
First real band?
Real band, yeah. You know, like, I was, you know, when you jam with friends and stuff. I played one or two local shows under the name, well, the first time I played a show was called Above City Lights, was my first band name. And then I changed it to Align the Life because I got in a huge fight with the drummer of my first band. He ended up sleeping with my girlfriend. And he like loved the band name. And so I was like, just to spite him, I'm going to come up with like a worse band name. I don't know what. So I changed it from Above City Lights to Align the Life. And I think those recordings are floating somewhere out there in the world of MySpace. Maybe. I think MySpace might have taken some of that stuff down. I don't know. But it's fine if no one ever hears those recordings. Because it was all self-recorded and it was terrible. So Ezra was like the first professionally recorded. First professionally recorded. And like I had a couple shows before that. But this is like the first like I never had fans until Ezra, you know.
Okay. That's true. I also know that you are really into spoken word poetry, mm-hmm. as well, and you don't just write songs. You also do that. What got you into that?
So my minor in college, so I was like, okay, my major will please everyone because it's like this smart, heady major. My minor was in poetry.
Okay.
So I did creative writing as my minor, and they forced you to take fiction. Well, you have to choose two out of the three, fiction, nonfiction, and poetry. So I did fiction and poetry. And originally I wanted to do fiction. I was like, I started writing a novel when I was younger, which later like literally became the exact plot of Inception. And so I quit. I quit writing it after Inception came out. So I got like 60, well, it was more than that. It was like a couple, like 100. It was like 75% done, like a full length novel. And then anyways, so, but I took this course in poetry and I was like, actually, this is really cool. Like my teacher showed me all these awesome poets. And I got really into it, and especially spoken word, because it was a little bit more. I enjoy putting on a show, and spoken word and slam poems and things like that. That's like putting on a show and a performance to go along with the words. And so I thought there was way more emotion when you could actually hear someone say their words. You can put inflection and stuff like that doesn't always translate correctly on page for everyone who reads it. So I really got into poetry in college. I started reading all the big name poets. I'm a huge Whitman fan, Behrman, and a lot of modern poetry. I listen to a lot of Anis Majgani. Who am I reading right now? Derek Brown.
Obvious choice because of the same first name.
Right, definitely. So yeah, I'm really into poetry, and I really like, except I think that's why I liked Whitman. I didn't like Emily Dickinson because I thought she was too heady and too out there. But Whitman was like, he's like, the dude sits there and talks about like the trees or the sea or like the ocean, and like, but something like really basic and simple, but the way he describes it is so beautiful, and he makes it so like there's this universal connection for everyone. And I'm like, that is how I want to write. And that's how I want to do music too. I want to be able to just like describe an everyday or common occurrence that we go through and make it that everyone, whether you're like living 200 years from now, 300 years from now, like we are from Whitman, and still completely relate to every single word that he's saying. And so, yeah, college is really where I found that passion. And
my buddy Mark, when we first heard Ezra for the first time, one of the first things he said was, I really like Ezra because of their lyrics. If you listen to them, you get this feeling of just like, it feels like poetry. It feels like he's taking you down a path, and you can take it, you know, whichever way you go. And also you guys have that sound too, that I don't know how to call it, but that kind of like big ethereal, like soundscape sort of style where it's not just heavy, like in your face. It's like the big reverb and lush sounds on the background and all that. So you get that kind of feeling too through the music.
I was heavily inspired, as I mentioned earlier, by Brand New and Modest Mouse. So Jesse Lacey is probably one of, you know, notoriously one of the best lyricists of our time and generation, who was inspired by Morrissey. And then if you also look at Isaac Brock, he's also known as one of the best lyricists. So I grew up on really lyric heavy. I love Death Cab, very lyric heavy. Bands that just like, and Jesse Lacey is definitely my most influential in terms of how I write, because he was unapologetic. He'll just cram words. he'll just overlap words. Mm-hmm. If you, especially in the early ones, you just hear like one vocalist and the next, and they're just like yelling over each other because he's got so much stuff to say on the topic that he's writing about. And like, and everything he says is just pure gold, of course. Every line is just like, they just hit you so hard.
When you write songs, do you normally write songs thinking of the lyrics first and then the music, or is it more like it's a hook and then it comes, lyrics come after?
Generally speaking, I mean, it really depends on the day. I don't think there's like one set way to write a song. So if you listen to, so it usually comes with, I'll think of a lyric, or I'll, if I think of a line or a lyric, and I don't think I'm necessarily this great lyricist, I just think I'm really good at capturing a good idea when it comes my way. I will stop my car, or I will like do horrible things and text and drive if I have to, and put that in my phone every time I think of a good line. My shower is where I think of a ton of good lines.
Yes.
And I have a pencil by my shower, and my roommate Matt moved in and took my old room, and I took a different room, and Matt, he's never let this go. Hey Matt, shout out to you, dude. my whole old shower is just filled, like the whole wall is filled of words, and like lines and like ideas. And so he like sits there and he like tells me all the stuff he's reading off my wall or my old wall. so I just really think it's about capturing a good idea lyrically, and then I write riffs or I'll listen to a song and I like the format. I really listen for structure and format when I listen to other bands. So I'll take a lot of like structures and formats I like of other songs and apply them to like riffs or sounds that I like. And so I kind of write like a basic song that way. And then I'll kind of compile lyrics that are about a subject, because subconsciously you're writing lyrics about ideas. I realize there's like themes to my lyrics, and like this whole album that I just wrote has very similar themes of just like going through a breakup, because for the last like 2 or 3 years I'd been in a really rough relationship. And so everything I've written lyrically for the last 2 or 3 years subconsciously was about some aspect of that relationship, and all the emotions stemming from that. So I will take, how I write generally is I have a whole store of lyrics that generally have different themes going to them, and I compile those, and then I have different riffs and ideas, and I try to get the emotions to align as best as I can. So if it's angry, I have angry riffs. If it's like happy or sad or whatever, and like the big sounds, the big landscape, that's just my personal preference on how songs should sound. It's how, kind of like I said earlier, how I was trying to find my sound. That's what I want to go for, that big epic, just, I don't know, not like Coldplay-ish, but like, I don't know, a less melancholy Coldplay, I guess. I don't know. I just like how big they get, you know? That's what I want.
Yeah.
Well, so let's talk a little bit more about Ezra then, since Ezra was the first big thing. How did, so you, and you said it was Adam? Was the
Adam
guitar?
Was the first guitarist, yeah. It was really me and him really started it, so.
And then, so you said the bassist and the drummer were already in that church band, and that's just kind of how you guys all got together?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the drummer, he went off and played for a couple other local bands for a while, too, and then he went off, he came back to us for, like half a year, but then he went off to do, go do the military and stuff, and, but yeah, that's my buddy Justin.
How'd that band come about? Like, what did you guys decide when you first started doing it?
So we had, like, we knew each other and we had a good working relationship as musicians, which I think is really important when you're writing, because of the church stuff. But then when I came back from college and I had just all these songs, I was like, hey guys, not only did I have these songs though, I said, I want to get these professionally recorded. And I went to, Corey Spots, who just did our CD we're working on right now.
Mm-hmm.
And Corey, he's the genius behind Arizona local music. He did Lydia's first CD that we talked about, Goodbye Tomorrow. He did The Drop for a Cowboy, Night to the Abyss that we talked about, Greeley Estates, Bless the Fall, It's a Little Formal. The dude is just a monster. So I was like, I hit him up and he's like, well, if you come in the next 2 weeks, I had a band drop and I'll give you like a 20% discount or whatever. And I was broke and poor, but I was like, oh my God, I'm going to do it. I'm going to go record with him. So I like got the rest of my band members from the church band was like, we got to go record with Corey Spots. He's like my hero. And, so that's really how it started. We went into the studio, we dropped two songs with Corey. They were received really well throughout the local scene to the point that we were finally getting show offers away. Like, again, it first started with no one knew us. We had no connection. So we were playing like parks and birthdays and mm-hmm. churches and whatever we could get in. And then eventually we got some breaks here and there. And on top of good recordings, it eventually just compiled into better shows and things like that. But making fans is a whole nother world. That didn't come till later. So.
Yeah, that takes a little while to make some fans. But
yeah.
So what are some? Do you have any memorable shows that you had with Ezra that you want to talk about? Some awesome shows or something that anybody you played with that you've always wanted to play with or anything like that?
I think it was like our second or it was like one of our first early shows after we had finally started getting real shows. So we finally like met some promoters. And we got asked to open. It was back when the clubhouse was still around. We got to open for the Higher and Quiet Drive at the clubhouse. And that was the first time we played with not only just like a major touring band, but a band that I listened to a lot and that I loved. Mm-hmm. So that was the first time I was like, oh, shoot, this is really cool. Like, I got to keep working my butt off so I can keep doing shows like this. So that was but that show was like literally the like 2 or 3 days before that show went down, my friend was like, hey, a band drop. I need a band to be at that show just to open it. So it was like completely just thrown on us. And we scrambled and got our butts to the venue and played the show. And my buddy, who the same videographer who videotaped the Still Voice music video, made like a student film based off of that show of me and my band like rallying to like get it to this venue in time, and like, and it showed like how we only play like birthday parties and stuff, and then we finally like rallied and played like a big show. And like from that moment forward, we got taken a little bit seriously. So that was like I think a kind of a changing point, at least in the early days.
Mm-hmm.
And then of course we've done, you know, we've played every venue at this point. We played Crescent, mm-hmm. Rebel and Rhythm Room and Pub and Nile, and we've paid our dues at playing at like Underground, and you know, we've
right.
definitely paid our dues. Recently, and this isn't Ezra, so this would be more recent, the Breaking Patterns first show was with This Century's last show.
Okay.
Which was a huge honor because yeah. This Century was another one of those big local bands that we just mm-hmm. really like loved and respected, and so we got to play with them at their farewell show, and that was a big deal. That sold out, actually. So our first show was like to 300, 400 people.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And then our second show, we co-headlined Crescent and sold it out, which was also pretty cool. You were there. That one was really cool. Was not expecting I knew we sold well and stuff, but it wasn't, you know, there was a lot of people that came through the door that I wasn't, you know, anticipating. So definitely like shows are getting better. I think our scene's getting better. The venues are getting better. Mm-hmm. The bands in general are getting better. Like the quality of music that's in Arizona is getting a lot better. And I have a lot of optimism, but yeah, in the past, like all the shows I could tell you some horror stories, but like the good stories are pretty far and few between. There's like a handful of, you know, moments, but
what was a memorable bad show?
Oh dude, I'm going to, this will be, oh man. There's a lot of them, but I'm going to tell you easily the most like embarrassing, horrible story. Oh my gosh. I hope no one hears this podcast now just for the story that I'm about to go, but well, I'm going to do the story.
We're about to launch this national, and this is going to be listened to the president's desk.
The whole world is about to find out. So, all right. Okay. So it was like the summer. So Ezra went on a hiatus for a little less than a year. And this is the only time that I almost quit music. And it was right after this show, and you're about to find out why. So, it was like the summer. It was like a summer between school. So, college is out. We're playing these big shows. Or we're finally able to play a lot of shows because I had so much free time. So, we got booked at the Underground at the summertime. So,
mm-hmm.
But I had a car that
so there's no
have...
air conditioning. Let's just, yeah. If anybody doesn't know the Underground, it's Nile Basement. The Nile Theater is the basement. There's mm-hmm. no air conditioning. It's very humid down there, very hot.
There's not there's not even a lot of ventilation. Yeah. Because there's two exits upstairs, and both of them go straight to the street.
Right. So and they've got like two fans down there, and I think one of them's broken.
Yeah.
So, all right.
Yeah, just like it feels like a hot air. Anyway, right. Enough on that. But I also have had a car that didn't have air conditioning. So, and it was a black Sonata. So I was driving to the venue. And I have a heat stroke while I'm in the car, and I get into a minor fender bender on my way to the venue while having a heat stroke. At the same time, that same summer, I had been undiagnosed with a – I had not been diagnosed yet with a disorder that I now know is called ulcerative colitis, which means my colon was bleeding. And I was, at this point, like a week or so without being diagnosed. I should have gone to the emergency room, and by the time I finally did go to the hospital, I had, like, suffered blood loss and needed, like – almost had a transfusion. So this is going to get a little graphic, but I was basically like blood out of my butt. Just was happening while I'm having a heat stroke and crashing my car.
Tuesday for a rock star.
Yeah. So of course I'm like loading in all this heavy gear and all that stuff as usual. So I finally get to the venue and I'm driving from Anthem. So it's a 45-minute drive and it's awful, whatever. So I get to the venue and like at this point there's like blood all in my pants and stuff, and I basically like go and get rid of my underwear and so I have to play the show without it. So that's the embarrassing part. But then not only that, this is the same one that I talked about earlier. It had 8 bands on this bill. My band did succeed in selling over 100 tickets at this show. I don't really know how we did that back then, but I guess, you know, Ezra, that was like the peak of Ezra, before the hiatus. And so we're like somewhat co-headlining this giant 8-band bill at the Underground. And my amp at the time had like blown up a couple times. So my amp actually, while I plugged it in, blew up while I was on stage and like smoke and stuff, all the works. And I was getting electrocuted from the microphone.
Oh.
So like to the point that actually like Adam told me like the electric could have killed me, like the amount of current that was going through it. So I'm getting... So our fans, like 100 of our fans, are sitting in this 120-degree underground basement, sitting through 3-4 hours worth of, no offense, but terrible openers. We finally get on stage. Before this, I find out that 2 of my band members want to quit. And so I have to rally them just to play the show, like an hour before the set. Like, this was one last show. We'll talk about it after. So I have to like rally my band while I'm shitting my pants. So I'm on stage getting electrocuted to the point of near death. I am shitting my pants to the point I have to get rid of my underwear. I'm bleeding out to the point that I need a blood transfusion. I'm having a heat stroke. I've crashed my car. I've lost my band. But here's the only good like little ray of sunshine in the story. We killed it. Like, not only did our fans love it.
The show must go on.
Yeah, we, like, did this cover of, like, back when Katy Perry did that E.T. song, which is still a badass song, in my opinion. It had, like, a really cool rhythm. We did the whole, like, we did E.T. and, like, me and Adam, instead of doing Kanye West, me and Adam, like, get down on our effects and start making all these weird alien noises with our pedals. And, like, and we had a girl singer back then who was, like, just killing it. And so, like, the crowd was, like, feeling us. And, like, so then after the show, I come to the promoter, like, hey, man, we sold you $1,000 for the tickets. And he gives us nothing, not a dollar. He was like, oh, you know, I'll give you any show you want in the future. But the dude wasn't a promoter like 2 weeks later. So he just like came, set up shop, took all his money and bailed. And so we went on hiatus after that. I was like, I think God wants me. You know, I'm going to take this as a sign. I almost died that night. And it was obviously not a good time. And I wasn't having fun. And I've, you know.
That definitely takes the cake of the worst experience or worst show.
I can't win that.
I've ever heard of anybody talk about.
Yeah, but I mean that, and that also goes to show though that I don't believe in giving up because I came back like after that. You know, I reformed the band after a couple months. I got my health back in order. I got new gear after I graduated, and we reformed Ezra, and we came back to the local scene, and we hit it hard, and we actually started gaining a really strong following. And it tumbled into what it is now, but it was not, I paid my dues, dude. And I think perseverance is the secret to any kind of success. And it's not that I'm successful now or anything like that, but there's no way. I have respect for any famous human being. I mean, a lot of them, you know, they had boatloads of money to get where they're at or whatever, or major connections. But you still just have to go through so much stuff just to have any moderate success that I can appreciate any local band who's gotten any form of success. And I can appreciate any major local band, even bands like The Main, who is super well connected. You know, I guarantee you they went through the ringer.
Right.
And they kept going. They're still going, you know.
So. That is awesome. Well, we are running out of time here. I did want to just talk to you a little bit. I know, like you said, you have a lot of love for the Arizona scene. And I know you also have some friends that are in some pretty good up-and-coming bands right now that are moving around. So, you know, is there anything that you would like to say to anyone in an up-and-coming band that's about to start up?
Well, I just went to my buddy, so my roommate Matt, who I was talking about, his band Never Let This Go, they had their tour kickoff last night, and they put on a great show. They put on a really good show, so I definitely advise, if you haven't seen them, go check them out. They're doing big things and about to go on a full U.S. tour. So big shout out to them. Big shout out to you and Mimelight, man. Hopefully we can get it. We haven't played in a while. We haven't played since that show way back in, what, Club Red, I think?
I know. It's been a while.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to start dropping names, though, because then, like...
Well, you don't have to drop names, but, like, if anyone's, like, wanting to get going and they want to start out, like, what would you say to them?
Okay, yeah, because there's so many local bands that get super political real quick if I just start dropping everyone's name. If there's any up-and-coming locals, and there's some, I've been helping out some locals, like doing gang vocals for a band recently. I think just stick with it. I think perseverance is a big thing. Obviously, you got to work hard. You got to pay your dues. And I think I see a lot of bands trying to like cut corners and jump. But I think at the heart of it, my thing is you got to put on a good show. You got to be cool and meet fans. If you want to make fans, the way to do it, and this is the trick that I learned, is you got to be a good human being and talk to people and be nice. And if someone comes out to your show, you thank them. And I do that every show. Anyone that I know that came to my show, if I'm friends with them on any social media, I always say thanks for coming out. It means a lot. So I think being nice to people is really important. I think persevering through the hard times, if you're shitting your pants, getting electrocuted, man, it sucks, but dude, like, just keep going. especially for people like me, like, I have to. It's not like really an option to give up. Like, maybe I'll never make it. I don't know, but I have to do this for me. Like, it, and if other people enjoy it along the way, then that is a huge blessing in and of itself. So I'm just grateful for where I'm at, what I'm doing, and hopefully other people can enjoy it and enjoy the hard work. But don't expect it to be a cakewalk. Don't come into the scene thinking you're too cool and you should be famous, because no one deserves fame. It just, if it happens, then you are the lucky one. So
very cool.
Well, so the new band is The Breaking Pattern, right?
Yeah.
So where can we find more information about you?
Definitely. We have a website, thebreakingpattern.com, but I would highly follow us on Instagram, because that is my favorite form of social media. Currently, we only have one single out. It's called The Rapture. You can hear it at thebreakingpattern.bandcamp.com. We're going to put out a new single here in about 2 to 3 weeks called Alaska, which we've been playing live. And it's been gaining some traction, so I'm excited to release one more single. And then we are anticipating on releasing the album in October. We haven't announced the name, but I will be posting a YouTube video also probably by the end of the month here with the official name of the album and a little bit more info about that.
Cool.
Good. Well, let's listen to The Rapture then here at the end of the podcast. We'll play that. We'll play the whole song so that people can get stoked on it if they haven't heard it. And but before then, let's just sign off then by saying thanks for listening to this podcast and thanks for coming on, Derek.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, man, it was awesome. This is cool.
Yeah, it flies by pretty fast.
Yeah, no, I enjoyed it. I want to keep talking.
So yeah, but as for us as well, I mean, continue to go to 480corecast.com. Continue to follow us on Twitter and Instagram at 480corecast, and make sure that you go and follow The Breaking Pattern on all their social media as well to keep up with their next shows when they're coming up.
Right. Go also like us on Facebook, 480corecast. Subscribe to us on iTunes, on Stitcher.
Leave a review.
Yeah, leave a review. Tell us what we're doing right. Tell us what we're doing wrong. Who you want to hear. All that good stuff.
So, yeah. So, again, thanks, Derek, for this. And up next, then, we will sign off by listening to The Rapture. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.
My mind when I am near you. This is good night, goodbye. 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 I lost my life out there searching for all the answers, and this I know will be a breaking one day. I am sold. Okay, even if it is the end. I lost my life out there searching for all the answers, and this I know will be that breaking one day. I am sold and you are the answer. I am sold and you are the answer. Darling, just forget times that we had, the days we stayed in bed, the nights made you laugh. Darling, just forget the summer that we spent.